this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
I saw agents reaching for their tear gas and readying it. I was thinking, like, what are they doing? Like, are they about to gas us again for no reason?
A jury has acquitted John Caravello of the felony charges leveled at him for standing by immigrants at the Glasshouse Farm in California.
They're normal people like all of us. They just want a better future for their families. They were literally in the process to fix their documents. There was zero reason for them to be detained. But that's another part of immigration enforcement of this kind of, in this country. Cruelty is the point of it.
Former ICE detainee Mahmoud Khalil speaks about his detention, trade unionism, Palestine, and Zionism.
The Iranian military leadership comes to Imam Khomeini in the middle of the war and says, look, we inherited from the Shah the capacity to mass-produce chemical weapons agent. We need to do this, weaponize it, and be able to retaliate in kind. And with the Iranian people being regularly subjected to chemical weapons attack, Imam Khomeini in the middle of the war said no, because this would violate Islamic morality. The Islamic Republic will not do this.
We revisit a 2013 interview with Professor Flint Leverett, author of Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. On May Day 2026, hundreds of thousands of workers are preparing to march and rally against a government that is smashing their labor rights, terrorizing immigrants, and carrying out war crimes from Venezuela to Gaza and Iran. John Caravello is an adjunct faculty member at the California State University Channel Islands campus, and he joined together with students to protect immigrants from a raid of the Glasshouse Farm only miles from the campus. They faced tear gas grenades, and Caravello was charged with a felony based on allegations that he'd thrown gas grenades back at the ICE officers. Caravello stood trial, and a jury acquitted him of all charges on April 9th. He spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
I've been at Cal State Channel Islands, which is in Camarillo, California, you know, north of LA in Ventura County. I started there about 8 years ago. I teach philosophy as a lecturer, so a contingent contract faculty member, but I've been teaching full-time for a few years here now. The campus is only about 2 miles away from where the Glasshouse raid happened in Camarillo. So it's a, you know, well-known area for me. I've been through that area many times before. The campus itself is surrounded by a lot of agriculture, and Ventura County is well known for being one of the highest producers of agriculture that feeds, you know, millions of people around the nation.
Around the world.
Around the world, that's right. Yeah, so I ended up going there that day. I was about to go to campus anyway to pick up a friend to do some daily patrolling, basically, where we would go around the neighborhood, just kind of see what's what, talk about recent ICE sightings. And of course, like if we find any ICE out there in the public, then we would send it over to the Rapid Response Network number, the hotline. A little bit before I was planning on going over there, I got news through either social media or a Signal group chat that I had been in for Rapid Response. I got the news that there was a likely raid happening at the Glasshouse. So I just jumped in my car and I drove over to campus and picked up a friend and drove to the site of the raid. It's important, I think, a lot of people might think that the protests themselves happened right outside the Glasshouse. That wasn't quite what happened. They actually closed down the road that led to the Glasshouse. So I was maybe half a mile to three quarters of a mile away from the actual raid, right? I found myself on a sort of barren road, very sort of thin roadway that would normally lead down to the Glasshouse. And when I arrived late morning, there were only a few officers there. It wasn't clear who they were with. I later learned that although ICE was present, there were many other federal agencies present, including DEA, CBP, HSI, DHS, and then of course the National Guard was sent in. along with Camarillo, sheriffs over there.
So they were using helicopters, apparently, to chase farm workers off the fields.
They were, yeah. Some farm workers had, you know, had gotten out of the building. So from my knowledge, the way that the operation sort of kicked off was, you know, with no announcement whatsoever, they approached the warehouses themselves and just threw a bunch of tear gas into it. And no, you know, like, they knew there were younger people in there. They knew it, there were probably older people in there. But I mean, just regardless, there's people in an enclosed place, right? They're trying to gas them out, essentially. A lot of people end up running into the fields and hiding. Some people end up in nooks and crannies of the warehouse itself. Some people end up on the roof of the glass house. And of course, we know that Jaime Alanis was tragically, you know, as I see it, murdered by being run off that roof where he fell to his death. And succumbed to his injuries ultimately later on, I think that day or the next day. The whole event is still a bit surreal to think about. It was brutal, right? I did not anticipate being in a situation like that. But of course, I was going to be out there. Like, I had students out there. I had friends out there. I have, you know, these are my community members. These are people that I know and love and or otherwise just don't know and deeply respect anyway. The workers who were in that building, who were, you know, in trial last week, the officers who spoke on the witness stand for the government's case said things over and over like, we were executing a warrant to collect evidence for unlawful labor practices. But I think we all know why they were actually there. They were there to collect people, not evidence, right? And they ended up with over 300 detainees and a few U.S. citizens as well.
And this attack, you went there with other people in the community. I mean, people are concerned about their neighbors getting arrested, being attacked by ICE. I mean, it sounds like, I mean, this is an area that has been targeted, like Los Angeles, to intimidate and terrorize people. The attack that you describe is pretty horrendous, throwing tear gas into a confined space.
Yeah.
Chasing people out of it.
Yeah, it's terroristic in some sense, you know, and I don't use that term lightly, but these tactics, the brutality of the tactics were awful. And then the fact that they were trying to keep a perimeter as well and had essentially many officers, you know, that ballooned over throughout the day. The fact that they had these people using all sorts of crowd control tactics, you know, almost seemed like they were given the green light to do whatever they needed. You know, I'm fairly well versed on use of force policies for both county and city police and also federal agencies. It's pretty clear that when there is no tactical or practical reason to deploy tear gas, right, to disperse people, that you shouldn't just be throwing tear gas at people, tear gas canisters, right? And I saw it multiple times before the incident for which I was arrested. And then I saw it multiple times after that incident and before I was arrested still, because I wasn't arrested until about 2 hours until after the incident I was actually arrested for. And just to be crystal clear, right, there were stories written when I was first taken about how it seemed as if I was arrested for dislodging a tear gas canister from underneath a protester's wheelchair. And I did do that. And I was arrested very, very soon after I did that. However, that wasn't ultimately the reason that they gave for arresting me. The reason they gave for arresting me instead was because I threw a tear gas canister earlier. And I did throw a tear gas canister earlier, and I threw it 20 feet above and 50 feet past any of the officers. Nobody felt the effects of it. You know, I've been telling people over and over that if we're at a protest, the least we should be able to do is keep each other safe in ways that don't have the consequences of harm to anybody, right? To be then subjected to these charges, of course, which were escalated to a felony assault charge on a federal officer with a deadly or dangerous weapon. To have to be subjected to that, be essentially incarcerated outside of prison by being tracked, random drug testing, all types of bail conditions for 9 months. It's just absurd. And this was all borne out in last week's trial where the government had no case. Their arguments fell apart.
And there were videos of this incident.
There were videos.
Were these ICE agents questioned about the videos and what had actually happened? I mean, what did they say? I mean, apparently they falsified the incident.
Yeah. Yeah, so we caught on cross-examinations, we caught the, or I should say, my wonderful defense attorney, Knute Johnson, caught the officers just lying through their teeth, right? So, for instance, there were several videos that showed the actual incident and what was going on in the incident. There were two federal vehicles trying to exit the area on the shoulder of the road. The road itself had cars in it, so they weren't going to be able to drive through the road. Right, so they were using the shoulder at that point. There was a single person who seemed to stand close to one of the cars, and he was subsequently pushed away before being ordered to move away. Right? He was pushed first, pretty brutally, but he was moved out of the way. Nobody else was anywhere near the cars, right? And so as they slowly moved down the shoulder of the road, I saw agents reaching for their tear gas and readying it. I was thinking, like, what are they doing? Like, are they about to gas us again for no reason? Right. And sure enough, right, one of them throws it. I go to try to kick it out of the way. I miss the kick and turn around and throw it as far as I can. Now, we see all of this on video. As that happens within just the span of a few seconds, the two federal vehicles that were moving had already sort of passed and they were gone. They got through, right? Yet both of the officers who testified that they needed to use tear gas in that situation because the cars were surrounded by protesters. They kept saying that. It was surrounded by protesters. And we just played the video over and over, and we played it frame by frame and asked them where, right? And they would say, you know, we'd have a frame up, there'd be no one near the car. They'd say, right there, they're surrounding it. It was absurd. It was wild to see them just lie through their teeth like that. They also said that they needed to do it to disperse crowds for the safety of officers, but there was no indication that anyone was posing them any danger. The prosecution itself also, you know, seemed to, in my eyes, conspire with the Border Patrol witnesses by, so the tear gas canister that they brought to court as a piece of evidence and plopped down, which with a huge thunk on the witness stand table, was a triple chaser, which is a specific kind of tear gas canister that breaks apart. And I noticed right away, I was like, that's not what I threw. I know I didn't throw something that big and that heavy, right? And yet both of them were questioned about it. Hey, you know, things like, does this properly reflect the kind of tear gas canister you were using that day? Yes, it does. Oh, can that do damage to someone? Yes, it can. If it hits them in the face, it could break their teeth, it could break their eye socket, so on and so forth. We ended up in crosses. We made it clear to the jury that that was not, in fact, the tear gas canister that was thrown, right? And we did this through looking through the use of force narratives that are required by federal agents to write up after their use of force. But ultimately, you know, just to see the weight of the entire United States government, right, who's the other side in this case, have witnesses lie through their teeth and also try to bring in evidence to, you know, speak to my character, to make me look worse. It was, I can't really say it's disheartening because it's not really surprising, but it was awful to watch.
I mean, this seemed to be a frame up where they lied, committed really acts of crimes, you know, lying about what happened when you had the evidence. They actually faked an incident that didn't happen
That's right.
in order to
That's
get you
right.
convicted.
Yeah. And they think that because I had to suffer from everything from PTSD to physical effects to lack of sleep to the trauma and terror that comes with being surveilled every day.
How are they surveilling you every day?
So for 8 months, I was on an ankle electronic monitor, a big, bulky ankle monitor. The U.S. magistrate judge who presided over my bail hearing essentially just placed these restrictions on me, these conditions on me, even though neither the prosecution nor anyone else in, you know, involved in the case recommended that I have these. So I had like a $15,000 surety bond, which is like really, really low. It indicates I'm not a flight risk. I'm, you know, not a danger to the community and stuff like that. And yet they fit me with this ankle monitor, which I had on for 8 months. When I finally got the ankle monitor off, they put me on it, and that tracked me everywhere I went, by the way. So they knew where I was at all times. I had a curfew attached to it. So 8 p.m. to 5 a.m., I had to be home, right, for 8 months. When I finally got it off, they switched me on to something called the SmartLink app. It's run by the same company that owns the ankle monitors and the electronic monitoring systems. And it The way it works was, since I had a curfew, it would ping me at four times at random in my curfew. So the time I had to be home. So 8 p.m. to 5 a.m., it would ping me usually in the middle of the night. I could be woken up to four times. And this went on for 2 weeks until we were able to get it in front of the district judge, who was the one who presided over my case in the trial, and she lifted it and lifted the curfew. And that was
Yeah,
about a
so
week.
they were using this instrument to harass you, basically,
It's
to
the punishment, right?
they were punishing you.
Yeah, it's a, you screw with us, the almighty powerful US empire and state, right? Then you will face consequences. Even if we know we can't win a case, we know what we can do to you, right? And I viewed it as, well, for me, of course, it was awful. The whole experience is traumatic and stuff like that, but I never could put my head down. Like, I had to keep moving. I had to keep organizing. I turned my attention more internally towards my own union organizing, because that's, sort of less out there. I had to back a bit away from organizing in my community in the ways I normally would, but that's okay, right? I never actually stopped this. That's, one of the things that has become very clear, is they think that this is working as a chilling effect. I don't know if they're not paying attention, if they actually realize this, maybe, but from my perspective, it is lighting a fire under people, and people are coming together in ways that I haven't seen before. And in particular, in certain labor circles, right, there are people that are pushing for something closer to a united front towards defending everybody, not just members, but our community members, from these brutal attacks, right? To repress us. Because we all agree. I mean, I think we all agree. I hope your audience agrees. Like, these are kidnapping operations. These are people, these are workers who contribute to our communities as much as you and I do, right? And they are regular people just like us, and they are being terrorized. Right? Families are being ripped apart. They're being detained. These detention centers themselves are, call them concentration camps, call them slave labor camps. Like, who keeps those places up, right? It's the inmates who keep those places up, right? And they don't get paid anything for it.
Well,
So
companies are making billions
they are.
profit on the prison industry,
They are.
GOP and
Geo
others.
Group also owns BI Incorporated, which itself owns all the electronic monitoring systems and the apps for these systems, right? So yeah, they're lining their own pockets with this stuff. It's terrible, but so much to say.
The union movement, I mean, as I was mentioning to you before we got on, Sanghae Kyil was a professor at San Jose State University who supported an encampment, and they fired her. The universities are targeting faculty members, workers, union workers, UAW at UCLA members who were supporting the encampment, arrested. And the people that attacked that encampment, no prosecutions really. The pe people that physically assaulted
That's right.
the peaceful picketers. So the question of the unions and what the union should be doing, was your experience with the CFA? It's a statewide union affiliated with the SEIU, has 30,000 members. What was your experience in trying to get them involved, and why they took up your case and actually rallied, had a rally for you when you had your court victory?
Yeah, so CFA did, so CFA, wonderful, my wonderful union, led by fearless President Margarita Berta Ávila, who's been nothing but just perfect throughout this whole process. They jumped on it immediately. I'd be remiss to not mention that many of my students, former students, and friends jumped on it just as quickly and coordinated with the union, right? Faculty from all over the state and staff as well, our staff, our paid staff, right? To first locate me, then do their best to get a lawyer in to see me, then find a lawyer who would be willing to, cover my case, and if possible, pro bono, which they did. It was into, I didn't pay a dime for any of this, right? In the end, they coordinated with my family in Arizona to make sure they were making the best decisions for me. It was done respectfully. It was done in an organized way, and it was done with like deep respect and love for me, right? And I'm so deeply not just grateful, but proud that people came together. They pushed aside any little quarrels they may have had in the way that our union runs and all the disagreements that might come, you know, with labor organizing. They pushed that aside and said, like, this is one of ours. We need to do everything to support him. So for 9 months, there was a union support team that fluctuated anywhere between 10 to 50 people would meet weekly with me to make sure I had everything I needed and organize for what was to come. We had a press conference the day after my verdict, for instance. That wasn't just, you know, hey, let's throw a press conference, right? Now, that was a highly organized press conference that we got in contact with several other unions, including UTLA, including SEIU, USWW, I think, California, CIU, and a couple others, right? And we spoke directly, our officers spoke directly with their officers, which is powerful because the way that unions work, right? The officers are the ones who ultimately have the most say because they sit on their boards, right? They're the decision makers in a lot of they're supposed to be representative of us, of the general membership, of course, but they're the ones pulling the strings for where the money and the resources from member dues actually go, right? And my, you know, CFA has, they didn't flinch, right? They immediately jumped into it and gave me what I needed, helped me find that lawyer. And then when I was starting to sort of recenter myself and realize like I'm not getting convicted of this. I'm working under that assumption because I'm not going to operate from fear, right? I'm going to operate from a place of power. And as soon as I got to that point, I was like, we need to start organizing so that whatever this is, this model of support that has so quickly coalesced around me in order to help me and help get me free, we need to figure out a way to copy this and paste it for every single person going through this, not just union members, because that's a very small percentage of the working population, but every person who's part of the working class. There are people being brutalized every single day, for instance, in downtown LA, at the LA Metropolitan Detention Center, who are out there to continue to draw attention to the fact that there are thousands and thousands of people detained in there for nothing, right? And they continually are being brutalized. They have their eyes shot out, right? There have been several cases of that recently. I've, you know, had the honor of meeting with several people who've gone through trials, who've been charged with nonsense crimes, right? And I brought them into the circle. I asked them to speak at my press conference, at the press conference after my verdict. And I, you know, our president Margarita opened, but they came right after because I wanted the focus to be on the fact that this is this larger issue that is not even just constrained to immigration related defense, right? But has to do with our civil liberties at large. It has to do with our rights or responsibility to protest against not just this administration, but every administration that, you know, continues to push for a world that prioritizes profit over people.
That was CSU Channel Islands faculty member John Caravello, who faced felony charges for standing by immigrants at the Glasshouse Farm in California. Caravello stood trial and was acquitted of all charges on April 9th.
Terrifying times with masked police occupying American city streets, raiding homes and detaining anyone who might be remaining, separating children from mom and dad, the only family the kids had, sending them to another state, trying so hard to make us great.
In response, the people say, you won't be alone as long as we have a whistle.
Called a monopoly on unaccountable brutality. There may be thousands of them around, never mind the frozen ground, but at least one thing for real is a lot of eyes are peeled, ready to stop and see the men of the CBP.
In response, the people say, you won't be alone as long as we have a whistle and a
That was David Rovix, performed by AI Tsuno, A Whistle and a Phone. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Polina Vasilyev. Mahmoud Khalil was a Palestinian graduate student at Columbia University and a member of Student Workers of Columbia UAW 2710 when he was abducted by ICE last year. The Homeland Security Department held him in detention for 104 days at the LaSalle Detention Center in Louisiana until a federal judge ruled that his detention was unconstitutional. He spoke last week at San Francisco State University about his detention, labor unionism, Palestine, and Zionism.
Injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere. So that's like, it's not about injustice against Palestinians or immigrants, that they are different. And the fact that Jena, Louisiana, or that detention center, it's literally in the middle of nowhere, as in the closest city to it is about 1 hour something from there. It's in a swamp, like you're surrounded by a swamp. So like you can't, like if someone wants to visit you, they cannot. And that's purposely why they put such immigration detention in remote areas so that they can prevent visits, they can prevent legal support. Because again, that's part of the punishment, because they want you to not fight your case so that you sign your deportation documents and leave the country immediately. And to be honest, like before my detention, I had no idea what immigration detention is in this country, to be honest. And because I was basically in 2 years, I applied for US citizenship. I had no reason to think about immigration detention. It wasn't that huge thing at that time. But then, you know, by my arrest, they started this mass deportation machine in the country, and you would see more arrests across the country. But basically, inside, I was in like a room much smaller than this one, with over 70 men, like bunks everywhere. Always the fluorescent is always on. It's so cold, you get a very thin blanket, no pillow to sleep on. The food was terrible, as in like very close to inedible. You would eat it just to survive. And all these are by design, are not like because there's too many people or because like they don't have money for that, because that exact detention center was a for-profit detention center run by GEO Group, which means they literally profit off people being detained in that detention center. And the people around me, literally most of them, I would say, were picked up from their either court hearings, immigration court hearings, from their ICE check-ins, or from their work sites. That was like the vast majority of the people there. And you can see the defeat in their eyes, because on the news you can only listen or hear that they are criminals. And to me, like when I, you know, like, because there you only have time to talk, basically. Like that's 24/7 what you do. They're normal people like all of us. They just want better future for their families. They were literally in the process to fix their documents. There was zero reason for them to be detained. But that's another part of immigration enforcement of this kind of in this country. Cruelty is the point of it, that they want to be as cruel as possible, so that others would leave immediately. But also, I always say that it's all a test case to implement on US citizens. Because all these thousands of ICE agents, and we've seen it in Minnesota, like that was like in a clear example of what this militia is doing. And this is all a test case for how they can come after everyone who disagrees with what this administration believes in. No matter what your color is, no matter what your social status, what your citizenship, is, they would come after you, because that's the whole point, because they want to be as fascist as possible. So literally, like, if, and that was like the first thing when I left. That was the first time I see that clip, by the way, when I left the detention center. Because the moment I stepped out, I really was about to cry that it only took me, I don't know, like 20 steps to be out of the facility, to feel free. And I looked behind me, there was a yard where, you know, we would go out for an hour a day. And just leaving all these incredible human beings, like, being in that place for doing nothing. And just so you know, immigration detention is civil detention, that's what it's called, which means it shouldn't be punishment. Like, it's not to punish anyone. It's just like to gather people to send them to their countries. But what's happening in this is the total opposite. And I don't know what, I mean, civil detention is not even, I don't know, like, it's a very cruel term as well, because detention is detention. There isn't anything civil about detention.
Regarding labor, because I was a member of UPTI, University of Professional and Technical Employees, and I worked out of UCSF for 18 years. Unfortunately, the resolution that we got passed in 2021 in solidarity with Palestine, the new leadership withdrew that, unfortunately. They didn't withdraw it, they just scrubbed it from the website, and they prioritize contract negotiations instead. Also, the other very disappointing thing that I realized was that the UAW Region 6 and 4811, this California area that represents graduates, have endorsed Zionist Scott Wiener. So Scott Wiener has been very pro-Israel. He's attacked Dr. Rupa Myra from UCSF and got her fired, and he's also supported AB 715, which prohibits any kind of criticism of Israel in educational settings and other settings as well. So I think we need to step up the game and get the UAW to rescind that endorsement. Also, for May Day, I'm wondering, basically, my question is, you know, what would you suggest for May Day? Because we're going to have a May Day, a rank and file May Day at 3 o'clock in front of Harry Britt Plaza. That's across from the Ferry Building. For rank and file members and students, everyone can come talk about what they think should happen. The San Francisco Labor Union, Labor Council, which, by the way, did not allow a resolution for Palestine to pass that I was when I was a member of the as a delegate. The AFL-CIO, obviously, and given Jeff Shirky's new book about labor Zionism in the U.S. So what would you recommend?
No, to be honest, like, as you said, that, you know, now they think that the contract conditions would be the main issue, while in fact, it's not about, like, labor conditions. It's about, because the same happened at Colombia, where they wanted them to focus on labor conditions, but how can you go to work when there's a genocide happening? How can you go to work when your immigrant friend is being targeted? So I would say, like, just like to double down on the connection between, like, work conditions and these, what they say, political statements, because they are not at all political statements.
That was Mahmoud Khalil speaking at San Francisco State University about his detention for pro-Palestinian activism. He was responding to the question of a union activist in the crowd.
The leaders of the U.S. do a lot of moralizing, praising themselves while always demonizing all the countries that they put on their demonizing list, with random characteristics, but usually the gist is they have resources that the empire desires, so they make up a pack of lies, as might be required, so they can launch an invasion. Whoever's on the throne, this evil axis really stands alone. It's all very clear as history relates. The axis of evil is Israel and the United States. They talk of other countries oppressing their own folk, gunning down protesters. This is certainly no joke, but it pales in comparison with what the evil axis does every time they bomb a hospital where the maternity ward was. It's all very clear as history relates. Of evil is Israel and the United States. Yes, there are nasty rulers leaders, kleptocrats and cons. But when it comes to places like the Gaza Strip or Lebanon or Korea or Vietnam, a few years before today, no one carpet bombs like Israel and the USA. It's all very clear as history relates. The axis of evil is Israel and the United States. Situation to have to keep on singing about this evil axis, all the suffering they're bringing. No matter how much they lie, it's impossible to ignore. It's this evil axis that is starting all the wars. It's all very clear as history relates. The axis of evil is Israel and the United States. It's all very clear as history relates. The axis of evil is Israel and the United States. The axis of evil is Israel and the United States.
From David Rovics and A.I. Tsuno, the axis of evil is Israel and the United States. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. Next, Flint Leverett, expert on the Middle East and author of the 2013 book Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran, discusses U.S. foreign policy in Iran in this interview with host Patty Satalia, recorded in May 2013 for WPSU's Conversations from Penn State. This 2013 interview remains significant today due to its prescient warnings about the trajectory of U.S.-Iran relations and its critique of the institutional failures that lead to conflict. Leverett challenges the narrative that the Islamic Republic is an irrational or ideologically driven actor that cannot be negotiated with.
Flint Leverett served at the National Security Council, State Department, and CIA, and is currently a professor of international affairs at Penn State. He and his wife, Hillary Mann Leverett, co-authored the controversial book Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. We'll talk with him about what he calls the myth of Iranian irrationality, about why he thinks U.S. policy toward Iran must change, and about what it will take to avoid war. Here's our conversation with Flint Leverett. Flint Leverett, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
To put it mildly, Going to Tehran is a bold, urgent book, and you wrote it with your wife, Hillary Mann Leverett,
yes,
who also served at the National Security Council. What was the impetus for writing this book?
After we left government, well, I should maybe talk about the circumstances under which we left government.
10 years ago.
10 years ago. We left the White House literally about 2 weeks before the invasion of Iraq started. And the timing of our departure wasn't coincidental. We thought that the Iraq war was going to be a major strategic error for the United States, that it would end up making the United States much weaker, certainly in the Middle East, potentially globally. Nothing that's happened in the intervening decade has made me reconsider that that judgment. And one of the things that struck us as we were inside government at the White House watching this unfold and not really being able to do much to stop it. All of the institutions that Americans are supposed to rely on to be a check on bad policy ideas, to ask the hard questions, Congress, the media, think tanks, public intellectuals, with a few very honorable, even courageous exceptions, most of those institutions rolled over for the invasion of Iraq. They never really
Why do you
really
suppose
challenged.
They rolled over?
I think that there's a certain element of just political cravenness in the aftermath of 9/11. No one really wanted to challenge the Bush administration. But I think it goes beyond that. I think in the end, most American elites, whether they're Democrats, Republicans, they have bought into the ideology or the mindset which also motivated the Bush administration. I mean, the Bush administration did took some things in directions where perhaps it hadn't gone quite so far before. But the basic idea, the basic model for the Bush administration's foreign policy is something that post-Cold War administrations, whether Democratic or Republican, have bought into. And I think that that's what the real problem is, that they basically buy this idea that America is supposed to be a hegemonic power, that it can be and is supposed to be a hegemonic power. And that's what we saw no one being really willing to challenge. And so after we were out of government and we became more and more focused in our own research and writing on Iran, U.S. policy toward Iran, we could see this was going to be the next crisis, if you will, in the Middle East. And we were determined that this time around, there was going to be somebody who was asking the hard questions and making the kinds of countervailing arguments that should have been made before the invasion of Iraq, but to a large extent weren't.
Well, and the book does that. And what I think is interesting about the book is that several years earlier, you had written an op-ed piece that couldn't be published. Didn't the Bush administration stop you from publishing
it? It was published.
Very similar in theme to your book.
Yes. In 2006, at the end of 2006, this was actually the first piece that my wife and I wrote jointly. It was an op-ed for the New York Times. It was based to a large extent on a larger monograph that I had published a few weeks before. As a former CIA official, I had an obligation to submit things that might pertain to anything I'd worked on in government. And I had done that from the time I left government in 2003, submitted everything from a book manuscript to lots of op-eds and shorter pieces. And the agency on its own had never changed a word. Everything, I know, I wasn't revealing classified material, go ahead and publish. But in this 2006 op-ed, the White House was beginning not to like the policy argument that we were making about Iran. And so even though the agency cleared it and said, there's no classified material here, the White House inserted itself into the clearance process, said, we insist that we also have to clear on this, and we want the following passages taken out. It was absurd. None of the passages contained classified information. It talked about our dialogue with Iran over Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda after 9/11, things that Secretary Powell had talked about in public, others had talked about in public. And so we asked the New York Times if they would do this, and they agreed. We published it with the blacked out passages that the White House had insisted on. And then we wrote a pre-seed, which the Times also published, that said everything that the White House has insisted on blacking out is in the public domain. This is an inappropriate exercise. And if you want to know what's in the blacked out passages, go to these things I've already written, go to this testimony by Secretary Powell. We just basically said, go look in these things and you'll know what's in the blacked out passages.
And so the effort really was to stop you in your tracks.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know what impact your book has had. And I ask that because it makes me think of Jimmy Carter's book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, mm-hmm. Which a number of people hailed it as a courageous book, but a much bigger group of people criticized it as being, in some cases, anti-Semitic.
Mm-hmm. Reaction to going to Tehran has been very, very polarized. Either people... really do say very laudatory things about it, talk about it as a courageous, important book, or else they don't just criticize it, they talk about it as in some way almost an evil or morally deformed exercise. And, there's very little kind of tepid reaction in the middle. Most of the reaction is very, very polarized.
Which is exactly what American politics are today. That polarized. And you and your wife wrote this almost as a desperate last attempt to prevent a war with Iran.
I think that is an important part of our motivation. We are on a trajectory with Iran where if the United States does not decide to change course, then I think we are headed toward another U.S.-initiated war in the Middle East. Our position in the Middle East is in free fall. We have had disastrous wars and occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan that have eviscerated the perceived legitimacy of American purposes for most of the people that live in the region. We've had a war on terror that we've conducted in a way that has alienated deeply most of the Muslim world. In that sort of environment, if the United States once again launches a war against another Middle Eastern country to disarm it of weapons of mass destruction, it does not have, in the current climate, with regional publics, with public opinion mattering more than ever, the blowback to the U.S. position in the Middle East will be disastrous. It will make the damage done by the Iraq War look almost trivial by comparison. And yes, we are trying to stop that.
You say four nuclear weapons Iran does not have. And most people who are rattling sabers say the goal here is to prevent them from getting it.
There is a way of preventing Iran from getting nuclear weapons. It's called the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. What these people are actually trying to get Iran to do is to surrender something that it is perfectly entitled to do as a sovereign state and as a signatory of the NPT, which is to enrich uranium under international safeguards.
You say on their own territory, as you said, with
international safeguards. They have a right to do that. What we are asking for is not that they not build nuclear weapons, because they're not building nuclear weapons. What we're asking them to do is to surrender the right to an indigenous nuclear fuel cycle.
Why are you so sure that they want to enrich uranium for purely peaceful purposes?
Because there's no evidence to the contrary. Now, I mean, I can't obviously offer any guarantees to what any country is going to do in the future. But you can look at what they've done up until this point. There has been no diversion of nuclear materials. They're not enriching anywhere close to weapons grade. I think there is a consensus of elite opinion in Iran that even obtaining a small nuclear arsenal would actually leave Iran worse off in terms of security, not better. And both Imam Khomeini, the Islamic Republic's founding father, and the current leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, have said repeatedly that nuclear weapons violate Islamic law. They violate Islamic morality. Now, you can say that's just talk. But there's an important historical precedent where the Islamic Republic didn't just talk the talk, they walked the walk on this.
You're talking about the war with Iraq.
The war with Iraq, where for years, Iraq is regularly using chemical weapons against not just Iranian military targets, but against civilian targets. And the United States is systematically blocking any action in the Security Council against Iraq for using chemical weapons on the Islamic Republic. The Iranian military leadership comes to Imam Khomeini in the middle of the war and says, look, we inherited from the Shah the capacity to mass produce chemical weapons agent. We need to do this, weaponize it, and be able to retaliate in kind. And with the Iranian people being regularly subjected to chemical weapons attack, Imam Khomeini in the middle of the war said no, because this would violate Islamic morality. The Islamic Republic will not do this.
Now, the interesting thing about the story you just shared right there is that most Americans have never heard that.
Yeah.
And you say that that's because Iran is being misrepresented in the Western media.
By and large, I think that's right. I think that there is a series of myths that shape the American narrative about Iran. And for the most part, media coverage buys into and perpetuates those myths. The myths are that the Islamic Republic is irrational, that it's this immature, ideologically driven polity that can't think about its foreign policy or national security in terms of material national interests. And so the idea of doing real diplomacy, serious engagement with it, that's just not possible. It is supposedly hell-bent on Israel's destruction, implacably anti-American, all of this.
But Ahmadinejad has said, for instance, in his speech in New York City when he was invited by Columbia University, he said that Israel should be wiped off the map.
What he said is that the phrase that he uses in Farsi is that it should disappear or vanish from the page of time or the page of history. If you look at very carefully at Ahmadinejad's speeches, speeches of other Iranian leaders who've talked about Israel, there's no doubt Iranian elites think that Israel is an illegitimate state. They think it is basically an apartheid-like state. But their argument is that in the 21st century, an apartheid-like state can't last forever. And when they talk about how Israel is going to disappear from the page of history, the page of time, they talk about it like the Soviet Union disappeared, or like apartheid South Africa disappeared, as a result of its own internal contradictions, not because Iran or anyone else waged an aggressive war against it. Now, I understand that's not a comforting scenario for Israelis or for friends of Israel, but it's not a threat to wipe Israel off the map. It's a saying that this is what is going to happen to Israel as it persists on its current trajectory.
If I'm reading you correctly, Israel is pushing the United States to establish this red line. And in fact, President Obama, in a recent speech, promised to defend Israel basically with all of its might. But how important is this red line? And what happens when the red line keeps moving?
Well,
the red line, we should say, is the point at which the U.S. will take action.
Yes. And the Israelis want to have this line very clearly defined.
And stated publicly
as when Iran reaches a certain level of development in its uranium enrichment capability. And, I think that's really very telling, because there is this notion, Israeli officials use it in public a lot, that Iran is, a nuclear Iran would be an existential threat to Israel. That's just nonsense. And even a lot of Israeli officials, the former defense minister, because if you actually talk to Israeli national security professionals, they acknowledge, in many cases, they've acknowledged publicly on the record, that even if Iran did have a nuclear weapon, that they're not, in fact, crazy. They're not going to use it against Israel because they know what would happen a few hours later.
We have 70 times the military
and certainly not against the and certainly not against the United States. What worries the Israelis, Barak and other military and defense officials in Israel have been very explicit about this. What concerns the Israelis is they have a national security strategy that is predicated on their ability to use force first, basically whenever and wherever in the region they want, for whatever purpose they deem necessary and whatever amount they deem necessary. And the problem with an Iran that has a certain level of even just latent nuclear capability, the ability to enrich uranium, which could, in theory, get translated into weapons-grade material. The problem with that, Barak has said this explicitly on the record, that the problem is the next time Israel thinks it needs to reinvade Gaza or reinvade southern Lebanon, it might have to think twice about it. Doesn't mean, according to Barak, they won't do it, but the decision-making would become more complicated. Now, that is not an existential threat. And I think for the Israelis to keep insisting on a kind of unrealistic red line, which is not grounded in any sort of international legitimacy, but is grounded in their strategic comfort, their strategic preferences. For the United States to attach its own policy to that, we are really courting disaster.
That was Professor Flint Leverett, co-author with his wife, Hillary Leverett, of the 2013 book, Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran, in conversation with Patty Satalia, recorded in 2013 for WPSU's Conversations from Penn State. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Zelter, Anne Garrison, Thomas O'Rourke, and myself, Paulina Vasilyev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.